Today's Taisho is on Case 36 in the Wumongkan, the Gate of No Barrier. Case 36 is entitled, When You Meet a Man of the Way. Goso said, when you meet when you meet a man of the way on the path, do not meet him with words or with silence. Tell me, how will you meet him? Mumon's comment, in such a case, if you can manage an intimate meeting with him, it will certainly be gratifying. If you cannot, you must be watchful in every way. Mumon's verse, meeting a man of the way on the road, meeting him with neither words nor silence, a punch on the jaw, understand if you can directly understand. So this is what is known as a koan. In Zen, for many, many centuries, teachers have used koans to help students wake up. One way to understand a koan is that it's a record of an encounter between a student, a Zen student, and a Zen teacher, or between two Zen teachers, two Zen masters. Sometimes it's simply a question posed by a Zen teacher. So the koans really record moments where Zen experience becomes possible. There are moments where people suddenly are pulled out of their everyday mental habits and they can see the world in a new way. And that's really the function of the koan. So koans often involve an exchange between a student and a teacher, and the teacher will ask the student some question, and the student will either be able to respond by seeing things in a new way or will fall back into his or her familiar way of thinking and interacting with the world. Many koans involve moments when the teacher poses a question to the student, and the student, maybe without expecting it, suddenly releases from his or her familiar mental habits and has a deep, immediate encounter with the world in a more profound and genuine way than people are normally able to achieve. Sometimes koans will describe a moment when a teacher poses such a question to the student and the student isn't able to answer. The student isn't able to get to that place. And sometimes, as I said, the teacher just poses a question. And it's directed, you could imagine it yourself. So in this case, we're dealing with a koan that just poses a question. Goso said, obviously he said this to his monks, when you meet a person of the way on the path, in other words, the person of the way is a person who is awakened, or deeply awakened, we could say. Do not meet him with words, and do not meet him with silence. So what's the appropriate way to meet the Dalai Lama or to meet a great accomplished practitioner? Goso says, don't meet him with words. That would be a big mistake because we know words can't really express reality. And don't meet him with silence because silence is passive and not active, see? So when you meet somebody with silence, you're not really responding in an active, living way. That kind of a quiescent, a withdrawn, detached response is not a good response either. So he says, then how? Tell me, if you can't meet him with with words, and you can't meet him with silence, how should you meet him? And now, this is the classic sort of form of a koan. In other words, you know, koans often involve a contradiction, which seems to be inescapable. You know, a famous Zen koan goes like this: if you have a staff, I will give you one. If you have no staff, I will take it away. See, that's a great koan, because it puts you right in the middle of a contradiction. So this is like a koan in Zen, and Zen teachers give students koans, and the student is expected to enter deep samadhi on the cushion before working with the koan. So, you know, there are people who completely misunderstand koans. My graduate director, my dissertation director, was a Renaissance scholar, a very well-known Renaissance scholar. And I was surprised to find that he was very interested in Zen. And he told me he was working on a koan. And I had been practicing Zen with Genki Roshi. And so I asked my teacher what koan was he working on. And he told me the koan. And I said, well, he said, I can't tell you the answer, of course. You know. That's a common understanding of koans, that there's like a standard answer. In fact, you know, there was a book for a while that was available called 100 Koans with Answers. If you go on Amazon, you can probably find that book. You know, it's probably on, there are probably copies in some used bookstore somewhere. But really, having a book of 100 Koans with Answers won't really help you, because that's really not the function of the koan. There isn't really a standard answer you can give. What the koan is asking you to do is to go through a process. So you know, when you try to solve a koan intellectually, when you try to think your way through a koan, it's likely that you won't be very successful. If you try to think your way through a koan, all you're going to do is respond to the koan in your conventional ways. You know, I am a writer, and among other things, and when I write, I try to say something interesting and original, often. And it's actually very hard to say something interesting and original, because most of our communication isn't interesting, and it isn't original, you know. Even some of our deepest thoughts are actually like cliches that we've picked up in our life, and that we carry down the road with us, you know. It's very hard to think your way out of conventional ways of behavior. Writers have to work very, very hard. You know, poets are probably the writers who are most successful. You know, poetry is an interesting kind of language, because it jumbles up words. It takes them out of their ordinary context, and it puts them in new contexts. You know, so when you are reading poetry, it's hard to understand poetry on a certain level. You know, the language isn't really readily digestible. You know, poetry works by taking words out of their familiar context and putting them to new uses, or putting them in new arrangements. And the result is a little bit disconcerting sometimes. You have to really work to understand a poem. You know, so most people who like poetry would say that, Joyce Kilmer is not a great poet. I think that I shall never see a poem as lovely as a tree. See, that's pretty conventional. Right? So most poets would say Joyce Kilmer was not a great poet. You know, great poetry doesn't just give us the familiar world, it shakes things up and it forces us to see in a new way. Yeah? And so that's why it's often hard. You know, a great art does the same thing, you know. You can sometimes look at a painting and say, "Oh yes, I can see a little valley there. I can see some clouds. Gee, I'd like to be in that valley." That would not really be a great painting, you know. Actually, a great painting would ask you to see the world in an unfamiliar way. It would ask you to see the world or experience the world in a new way, not in just reliving your familiar ways of seeing. So, the artists who are most respected by other artists are the artists who are really able to challenge familiar ways of seeing and force people to expand their sensual experience, you know. And this is why, by the way, artists are often not appreciated in their time. You know, I don't know if you are familiar with the British painter Turner, but Turner was a Victorian era's greatest British painter, and there's a wonderful movie called Mr. Turner that I highly recommend to you. Turner, when he was 17 years old, was one of the great, already thought to be one of the most accomplished painters in Great Britain. And he was able to live in a big house in London because his paintings were so popular. But then Turner began to push his painting in new directions. And his later work is really about, you know, really doesn't really represent anything anymore. He used to paint ships on the ocean. He was primarily a nautical painter. He'd paint ships sailing on the sea, and British people are seafaring people, and they loved his early work. But later, when Turner was at his height of his powers, you know, he often painted seascapes, but it's hard to see them as seascapes. You know, the play of light and form, of shadow and brightness, is so complicated, and the colors are so high key, you know, very bright yellows and aquamarines, you know, that it's hard to say what it's representing. And many of Turner's admirers walked away from him in later life. Even Queen Victoria said his paintings were a muddy mess or something like that. But, you know, Queen Victoria was maybe a good queen, but she didn't understand art. You know, what Turner did was to show people a new way of seeing. Another example of this is, some of you might know that when Stravinsky's Rite of Spring, Stravinsky's Rite of Spring was performed in Paris for the first time, it was such strange music, and the dancers performed in such an unfamiliar way that it actually caused a riot, and really a fight broke out in the audience. People came expecting a familiar piece of music, and they expected the dancers to sort of be like ballet dancers. And instead, there were these dancers dressed in these, almost naked, in these primitive costumes, and they were stomping their feet on the ground. And the music was a very heavy staccato-type music, and it was primitive and aggressive and unpleasing, you know, wasn't harmonious. And the French, you know, take art seriously, and people started screaming. They were throwing chairs, and the director was just sat on the edge of the stage and sobbed, right? You know, in other words, it was a big success. It was one of the greatest, you know, every composer after Stravinsky wishes he could have a day, or she could have a day like that. Because, you know, the artist is not trying to get you to relive what you've already experienced, but to go beyond the boundaries of what you've experienced. And you know, interestingly, people who reported on that performance in Paris, when Stravinsky gave that performance, you know, reported on the riot, reporters talked about the riot, the fight, they had to get the police in there, people turned the hoses on some of the rioters. You know, a year later, the music was performed in London, and it didn't create that stir. You know, the British just sat there and listened to the music. And it might be that British are just not, you know, as excitable as the French. But what it was really all about was by then people had read the sheet music, and they were more familiar with the experience. Now, you know, people listen to Stravinsky and they don't get angry, they don't throw chairs, it doesn't happen anymore, because our way of hearing the world has changed. See, it's expanded. Our way of hearing the world has expanded. You know, poetry does that too. You know, after you read a powerful poem, you know, you might never see certain events the same way again, because they really change the way you experience the moment. Well, anyway, koans are supposed to work like that too. You know, they create a contradiction that you can't work your way out of using your familiar ideas and your cliched familiar ideas and your cliched familiar language. You have to undergo a kind of like a gestalt switch in the way you're seeing the world. And you know, koans have to be internalized. You have to be in deep samadhi, sitting on the cushion, watching your breath. And when you're in that state of altered consciousness, where there are very few thoughts, you internalize a key, what's called a turning phrase of the koan. So in this case, it would be... You could either say neither speech nor silence, or you could just say, how will you meet him? How will you meet him? You could even just say, how? How? You read the koan a couple times, then you just say like a mantra, the turning phrase, you know, how will you meet him? On your out-breath, how will you meet him? See? And the koan is like a psychoactive substance, you know. It drops down through the layers of your mind and goes into your, you could say, your unconscious mind. And it begins to percolate. And, you know, and even when you think you're not working on the koan, it's really in there, and you're working on the koan. It's actually speaking to the deeper part of you, deeper part of you. You know, and I think poetry does that too. I think the arts do the same thing. You know, art that's really moving or powerful seems to reach down past our discriminating mind, our familiar thinking mind, and grab us at the heart, you know. And sometimes it can do so wrenchingly, you know, really wrenchingly. And in a way, this is a kind of liberation, right? I mean, you know, we go through life maintaining a facade of normalcy, right? We go through life, you know, since we're little kids, we learn to do what other people expect of us. This is how we manage social life, right? You know, so a lot of pre-childhood and childhood involves learning the rules of being human, and what do people expect of me? And then fulfilling those expectations in a way that doesn't produce a violent reaction or disapproval, or even better yet, acting in a way that will get the approval and admiration of others, right? So that's how we function as human beings. Some people get really good at meeting the expectations of others, you know, and they are rewarded for it, and that's wonderful. But in a certain way, that also traps us, right? Because all our lives, we're just acting out these, like we're like actors performing a script that we didn't write. We're just mouthing the words, right? We're just walking across the stage. There's a big X at the end of the stage. The audience can't see it, but that's where we're supposed to walk, and then we turn around so the other character can enter stage left, see? And we go through our lives like that. Please. Now, you know, that is how most people live, actually, you know, most of the time. You know, sometimes reality breaks through this artificial, this sort of like artificiality, you know. Sometimes reality breaks through because something unexpected happens, right? So, you know, the play is going on, and suddenly one of the Klieg lights explodes with a powerful, you know, blast, and half the stage goes dark. You know, at that moment, we all realize, oh, this is just a play. It's not real, right? And of course, in a theater, you know, you try to recover from that as quickly as possible. You try to get an alternate light down there. People go back to the script. You know, and in real life, events like tragedies happen, or unexpected painful events happen. You know, crisis happens, right? You lose your job, right? And now suddenly you realize it's all a play. It's all a state. We're just acting this out, right? And at that moment, you know, people are actually capable of being more authentic. You know, people can say, what is life all about? You know, I've been acting in this play all my life, and now the Klieg light is exploded, and I can't maintain that illusion anymore, right? Now, what is this all about? Why am I in this play? You know, who am I? Where am I going? You know, where do I come from? Right? Those are the questions people normally tamp down or use the play to avoid asking, right? Instead, just recite your lines. You know, normally when we try to think through things, all we do is use the conventional tools that have been so good for us in trying to adapt to society's expectations. But the function of the koan is kind of like creating a crisis. It denaturalizes our awareness of the world around us and forces us to sort of like reinvent how we experience the moment. Yeah. So if you sit with a koan like this one, you know, here comes a man of the way. How will you greet him? If you greet him with words, you're wrong. If you greet him with silence, you're wrong. Then you could say, well, what do I do now, right? I mean, you could think, I'll clap my hands. That would be neither speech nor silence, right? But that's just an ingenious formula that doesn't change anything. So, you know, you internalize, how will you greet him? How will you greet him? And it sinks down into your deep unconscious. And it's likely to trigger some very profound, could trigger some very profound reactions sometimes, you know. And usually they're connected to something that has closed us up. You know, so not always, but often when we're working with koans, you know, we're encountering obstacles that we've buried deep in our minds, you know, the things that we've pushed far out of consciousness and that keep us locked in these stereotypical ways of responding to the world. You know, inside all of us, of course, there is a person who wants to get out. You know, there is a person who wants to stop reading the script and wants to encounter life in a direct way. You know, the immediacy of the moment. And sometimes this happens. You know, sometimes this happens spontaneously. You know, so people go on vacations. I just came back from 10 days in the Southwest, you know. And it's wonderful to get up in the morning and not have to rise at a certain time and not have a script that you have to act out. And you might just go walking and you see something, you know, totally unexpected, and it just moves you deeply because you're not trying to fulfill anybody's expectations. You know, suddenly you can have sort of a spontaneous relationship with the world, at least in a superficial way. You know, but even if you go on vacation, sometimes you're unable to have those kinds of experiences, that sort of spontaneous connection to the world around you. You know, so the koan, the function of a koan is to sort of like silence the part of our minds which is always trying to please others, and allowing that person inside us to come out and have a natural experience of the world. Yeah? And if you think about it, this is really a, you know, when it happens to you, if, when you begin to have these kinds of experiences, it could be frightening. You know, we have a big investment in our the identities we've created and the lives we've made for ourselves, even if we find them boring or oppressive. You know, they're familiar, and you know they're safe, right? You know, there's something a little unnerving about leaving them behind. Yeah. Actually, you know, we all do have this craving for experiences that aren't, you know, stereotypical experiences that aren't socially expected responses. You know. And we begin to feel a different way about ourselves and about our lives if we can get in touch with that level, you know, of ourselves. You know, I can remember, you know, the first time I can remember, you know, working on the Mu Koan, you know, and if you're not that familiar with Zen, you know, in Zen, the way people start is by watching the breath. So you watch the breath maybe for months, maybe for a few years, until you can begin to enter deep samadhi. And samadhi is this, you could say, altered state of consciousness in which the sense of separation from the world around you begins to disappear. So, you know, you're thinking much less. Your mental processes are not so self-centered. You know, your self-awareness sort of moves to the margins. When you're sitting on the cushion and you're watching your breath, you might not realize it, but you start to experience the world in a very different way. You know, it sounds like the wind coming out of the vent overhead, or if you're sitting in a place where there's an open window, you know, you hear birds singing, it feels very crisp and present because you're no longer covering the world of your sensations with a film of thought. You know, you begin to experience the world around you in a rather thoughtless state, and all of your senses come alive. There's much more immediacy there, yeah? At the same time, your brain, your mind might feel a little blank, or even a little, it's like your head is stuffed with cotton. You may get that sensation. You know, but that's a samadhi state. And then in Zen, what we typically do, though not always, is to give the student a koan called the Mu Koan. If you watch your breath and you follow the breath out to the end, you'll notice that at the end of your breath, the mind becomes rather blank or dark. And some people experience it as blank and bright. But typically people experience it as when you follow the breath out, and you follow the breath out, eventually you begin to notice that at the end of your breath, the mind is blank and dark, see. And this is what we call in Zen, mu, wu, or nothingness. So typically a teacher will assign a student who has been able to enter deep samadhi the Mu Koan. And in that case, she will sit on the cushion and enter samadhi, and then instead of counting the breath, like 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, the student will start calling Mu. So on each out-breath, you literally silently call Mu. Mu, 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 like that, see. And when you're calling mu, if your concentration is very intensely focused on the syllable, mu, right there, you can't really have anything else in your mind except that. And when you get to the end of your breath, your mind is very, very blank, very, very blank. See, and this is a really long process, usually. People usually work with the mukhoan for a number of years. You know, when my teacher first gave me the mukhoan, I had already been having a difficult time in my Zen practice. You know, when I started Zen practice and training, I was a really probably pretty unhappy person. I was an unhappy person. And I was probably suffering from like an anxiety disorder and some low-level depression. So, you know, that was a challenge for me. And when I started doing Zen, I was given the breath perception koan, watching the breath. And of course, I brought to my Zen practice all the mental habits that created my unhappiness. You know, so when I was working on the breath perception koan, watching the breath, I was trying to come up with an answer that would win the praise of my teacher. And I noticed that many other people in the Zen group were answering their koans. So I was watching the... Genki Roshi said, watch the breath. Or he put it this way. He said, breath with eyes, where do you go? That's what Genki... I'd go in and say, I'm working on the breath koan. And Genki would say, breath with eyes, where do you go? And I had no idea what he was talking about. You know, and I tried to be... I wrote poetry... I performed for him, I brought him a sandwich, I brought him a flower. You know, I figured if I'm creative enough, if I show, you know, he wants something, there will be something that pleases him, that makes him reward me, right? And of course, this was the very sort of behavior that was causing me to get depressed in graduate school, right? You know, and in other venues in my life. So I was just playing out my familiar mental shtick. Right? Basically, I would look around at all the other people in the Zen group, and I imagined, and it was probably true, that they were all getting ahead of me in the competition for enlightenment. See? And that was, again, a mental habit that I brought to my Zen training that made me unhappy in my real life, and that was making me unhappy in my Zen life. Right? So eventually, I finished working with the breath, and Genki Roshi gave me Mu. And I was sitting on the cushion calling Mu, 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 you know, what is this all about? And the strangest thing happened. You know, people would go into the Dokusan room at Sesshin, and when they would call Mu out loud. And this is actually part of working with the Mu Koan, calling Mu out loud. And it seems like the silliest thing in the world. You know, you're sitting on the cushion and you're silently calling Mu, Mu, with each out-breath. Your mind is getting blank, and then you're expected to go into the Dokusan room and open your mouth and call Mu. And you would think this is, at first you think this is silly and you are self-conscious about it. In my case, strangely, when I went into the Dokusan room and I tried to call Mu, I couldn't call Mu. I was so blocked, right? I was so blocked, you know, it's like, I heard those other people calling Mu, and I tried to imitate them. I tried to call Mu with a powerful voice, but I couldn't even get a sound out, you know. And this went on for a number of years. You know, it's amazing I didn't quit Zen. You know, I was trying to call Mu, but I couldn't, you know, like get access to that part of myself which was deeper than my usual mental habits. You know, I couldn't get to that part of myself that I could trust, you know, or that I could let free, you know. You know, so it would go on like this for a number of years. You know, I would go to the Sesshin. I would try to call Mu. I couldn't open my mouth. One time, at the end of one session, Genki Roshi said, come on, just try it. You know, just call. But I literally couldn't open my mouth. I was so paralyzed. So anyway, you know, I finally decided, you know, everybody else is going in there and calling Mu, and I am unable to access that part of myself. And I sort of just kept plugging away. And one day I went into the Dokusan room and I opened my mouth, and it was just, it was like something inside me made it happen. It wasn't like my conscious self. There was just this spontaneous, like almost like an explosion of energy. Yeah, it doesn't always happen like this for people, but this is how it happened to me. It was like suddenly Kurt was no longer calling artificially. This was coming out of a deeper place in myself, and it was astonishing to me. You know, it was very loud and very powerful, and I can't really say I made any effort. It just happened. And when it was over, I was kind of amazed. Like, where did that come from? You know? This also happens to other people, this kind of thing, where you get in touch with this deeper part of yourself. If it is yourself, it might not even be yourself, you know? But there's something inside you which is deeper, and it's more natural in its interactions. And I got a glimpse of that. You know, it was like it came. That, where did that come from? Was that inside? You know. Athletes say this. You know, I remember reading this famous runner, and he said, "I don't really do it." You know, he gets to the starting block, and then he just says, "The next thing I know, the race is over," and I look to see if how it worked out. It's like, you know, he taps into something deeper than himself. And this happens with actors, too. You know, people who are actors will say, you know, the play starts and then it's over, and I'm not really sure what happened in between. It's like you could say they're on autopilot, but I don't think that's accurate. You know, ordinary consciousness is autopilot. We're just going through the motions in life. But sometimes, under extraordinary circumstances, or on the cushion at Sesshin, we can encounter this part of ourself which has no name. And it was there, you could say, long before we were born. And when we release that part of ourselves, it's absolutely thrilling and it's liberating. It's like nothing in the world. So, there is this part of ourselves which has no name and no age, and which is, you know, basically like a force of nature, you know. And who knows how long it's been there, you know. But in Zen, we learn to tap into that energy. And it gives us a different relationship to the world. You know, mostly our relationships to the world are neurotic, if you think about it. You know, we're trying all the time to please others. Right? And even in trying to please ourselves, we're still trying to please others, right? So it's a very artificial situation. And most of our relationships are like transactional, right? It's like, if you like me, I'll like you if you like me. A lot of our relationships are transactional like that, you know? And of course, they're always fraught with tension because, you know, for complex reasons, right? I mean, first of all, people don't always reciprocate in the way we want. And we try hard to be liked by others, but sometimes they don't like us. Sometimes they push us around, and sometimes we're just not a good fit. You know, and then we go home and we blame ourselves. We feel insecure about ourselves, and, you know, this is sort of a human comedy, right? You know, we're carrying this self around, trying to get other people to like it, trying to sell other people on it, and if they don't buy what we're selling, we get upset, or we feel terrible about ourselves, or some people try to burn other people, you know, to make them unhappy if they've been made unhappy. So, you know, our ordinary everyday responses are often, you know, deeply neurotic, you know, and it doesn't really solve very many of our problems. So, you know, people who get involved with Zen must know on some level that the everyday way of living is unsatisfactory. You know, that there is this, there's a possibility of something deeper and more natural. But, you know, not much in our culture encourages us to pursue this, right? nobody really wants you to be honest with you, many people don't really want you to be independent and spontaneous. You know, they would prefer that you be neurotic. You can be manipulated in that way. You know, as long as you're trying to please others, you know, you're in a strange relationship to them, right? You're easily controlled. And lots of people like that. You know, lots of people like making you controlled, or controllable, I should say. You know, so when you're a little kid, you know, you might, I remember when I was a kid, I was mortified once. My mother bought me a shirt, which I thought was the kind of shirt that the Beatles wore. And I was so proud when she bought me this shirt. And when I wore it to school, I thought all the kids would like me because I had a Beatles shirt. But I didn't realize that that shirt had really gone out of style already, right? You know, and somebody pointed it out to me, and I was really mortified. You know, I had thought this shirt was going to make me liked, but instead it sort of made me ridicule, target of ridicule. You know, this can be the way human relationships go. You know, sometimes they aren't transactional like this, or the transaction breaks down. You know, when we marry somebody, you know, it has a transactional element, right? You know, I'll love you if you love me. And we usually pick somebody who responds warmly to us, obviously, you know. And then sometime in the relationship, you know, you begin to realize that this is not the person you thought he was, or this is not the person you thought she was. And the marriage can go into a real crisis, right? Because, you know, you don't get what you bargained for. And there's a moment when the marriage can fall apart, but it could also be the case that you have to rediscover the person you married, and you realize, I don't know who this person is. And at that moment, you know, the relationship could become really quite wonderful, really wonderful. It's possible, you know, to have a really good relationship with somebody if you throw away the rule book and you aren't trying to be a husband and wife, you're just discovering the other person, you know. That's, I think, a better approach. So you know, you could say Zen is a little bit like that too. You know, you're going to stop being a husband or a wife or a mother and a father, or a mother or a father, and you're just going to allow the other part of yourself, the part that has no name, to interact with the world more spontaneously. And so, you know, even though it might seem silly for people to walk into a room and have to call out the syllable, you know, call out moo, that seems kind of ridiculous, many people find it deeply transformative, because it really involves trusting a part of yourself we normally don't give ourselves permission to access. You know, I'll never forget, there was a professor in the linguistics department who started to sit with us. And she's a wonderful person. I meet her occasionally, and she's a very, very good scholar, a wonderful linguist, and a very good administrator also. And she was coming to sit on Saturday quite regularly, but one Saturday I was talking about the Mu koan, and I actually, sitting on my seat, I actually called Mu, as we do at Sesshin, you know, sort of like as loudly as possible. And I think it really bothered her. She never came back, you know. Even though I have the highest regard for her, you know, I think I had violated something, you know. She felt maybe that I had violated something that shouldn't be allowed to happen. You know, I think she was, she didn't want to give herself permission to let that out of herself, right? She didn't want to allow that thing in herself to come out, right? And I sort of put it out in the middle of the room for everyone to see. But, you know, when you allow that thing to come out, it really transforms your relationship to the world. It's possible to completely, you could say, completely rebuild the way you interact with the world. It's not overnight, it's step by step. But we can have, you know, really more natural and spontaneous relationship to everything around us if we're willing to take the risk of encountering that stranger inside ourselves. So, you know, Zen practice isn't just about sitting on a cushion, calming the mind, and feeling a little better. You know, that would be helpful in some circumstances. You know, right now, mindfulness is all the rage. You know, people sit down on the cushion, they watch the breath, they pay attention to the moment, and they feel a little better. And then they go back to their work. You know, that is really not, from the Buddhist standpoint, liberation. You know, the Buddhism has a deeper, a bigger project. It has a deeper understanding of human life, I would say. You know, just calming the mind enough to function is not liberation. You know, liberation is really changing who you are, and really freeing yourself from all those expectations that you have picked up over the course of your life, and encountering the stranger, the really wonderful stranger inside yourself. That is a daunting proposition, maybe, but when people begin to taste that freedom, it's really changes them. You realize life could be very different. You know, right now we're in a real crisis in terms of our civilization. I was just reading another article on global climate change, and it connected climate change to other problems with the environment. And you know, environmental scientists just tear their hair out and they think, why aren't people responding? You know, people are so dissociated and seem so indifferent. But, you know, as a Zen teacher, I'm not surprised by this at all. You know, our natural response should be very different, but we don't normally respond in a natural way to our world, right? We're very controlled. We have a lot of self-discipline. We tamp down our natural responses because we don't trust our natural responses. But, you know, if you think about it, our way of life is really not healthy in almost every possible way. So maybe the time has come to be a little bit of a rebel, you know, a little bit of a rebel. And not so, be so trusting of the social scripts we live by, you know. You know, when you sit down on the cushion, it's in Zen practice, it's not just about being a better actor on the stage. It's about rewriting the script, or you could even say throwing the script away. You know, Zen in particular and Buddhism in general are really about being free and not being more effective in your servitude, you could say. Gosho said, when you meet a person on the way, do not meet him with words and do not meet him with silence. So your response has to come from a much deeper place in yourself. Tell me, how will you meet him? See, if you get the book 100 Answers to the Koans, 100 Koans with Answers, rather, it won't tell you how to meet him. You could ask the Dalai Lama how you should meet him, but that won't help either. You know, it's up to you how you meet him, and you should meet him with the deepest part of yourself. Momon's comment: In such a case, if you can manage an intimate meeting with him, intimate. In other words, all the masks are thrown aside. All the guards are down. And that's intimate, right? All the contrivances are aside. All the masks, all the pretense. When we're intimate with somebody, it doesn't mean we're sexual. It means our boundaries, our defenses are put down. And we're able to be open and truthful, natural. In such a case, if you can manage an intimate meeting with him, it will certainly be gratifying. But if you cannot, you must be watchful in every way. You know, back to our neurosis, right? Mumon's verse, meeting a person of the way on the road, meet him with neither words nor silence, a punch in the jaw. Understand, if you can understand directly. That is from the deepest part of yourself.